Don't move, just leave your doll out here on a tour. Lean back and stay a while now.
This is Monitor on January 20th, 1968, and we'll hear from a man who's been a favorite of many music lovers for years, Duke Ellington. That interview, 2 minutes from now. Later on, we'll meet a millionaire hotel tycoon, Preston Robert Tisch. I'm your host, Ted Steele.
See how the fluffy clouds move by.
House Hills and We Can Fly. We could fly, musically anyhow, when this song first became popular. Yeah, Mood Indigo by Duke Ellington. And through the years, the Duke has been a unique force in popular music. His latest unusual activity? Last evening, a sacred work he has been writing between nightclub engagements had its premiere performance at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine here in New York. 5,000 seats were filled, and the proceeds went to Exodus House, which cares for drug-addicted youngsters. How the Duke feels about his career in music and his songs was the subject of this recent interview. The reporter, Frank Knight.
Duke Ellington, of all your compositions, which one would you like to be remembered by?
Oh, the one I'm going to write tonight.
Who is responsible for titling your compositions, your sophisticated ladies, your mood indigos, and things
well,
like that?
Well, those are all my titles. I've been doing that. I mean, that's what I... Well, to find a fitting title or to find music that actually reflects a title or a mood which you establish before you do the writing, it works both ways. And it is fitting to have a match.
When do you do your writing, Duke Ellington?
Anytime. On the bandstand, in an automobile, in a plane, bus, in bed.
Did you always want to be a pianist? How did it come about?
No. My first recognized talent was painting. I won a scholarship in fine art to institute. But by the time I finished high school, I was much too deeply involved in music to turn it away from it at that time. I had bought a house and an automobile and was doing very well. So I just postponed it a year and another year and another year and another year and another year. So who knows, maybe I'll go back to it.
Who was responsible for changing your name from Edward Kennedy Ellington to Duke?
Well, Well, in the high school, I used to pal around with a guy who was a pretty flashy guy and pretty smart, Edgar McEntry. And I've always said that I thought that he felt in order for me to be eligible for his constant companionship, I should have a title. And it's been that way ever since.
Looking back over your life, can you pick out the highlights?
The highlights? Well, like the first time we played Grace Cathedral. First time to stand up in a cathedral and say out loudly and present with a big musical formation the thing that you believe in so that the world can hear it. This, of course, is probably the most exalted position I've ever been in.
When it comes time for you to retire, where will that be, Duke?
Well, I don't know about retirement. I have no plans for it. What do you do when you retire?
Well, I mean, as far as your home is concerned, where will that be? Will it be in New York? Will it be on the coast?
Retire is the word. I mean, as a, we don't use the word. Good. What does it mean?
Well, as far as the popular sense is concerned, to get away from work and to take it easy and do the things you like and love, which I guess is what you're doing right now.
Well, I mean, what else am I going to do that I like more than music? I mean, because, I suppose it's impossible for you to know everything that we do, but I mean, it's, when you're with something, you're doing at the same time you're working these public appearances, you're writing a show, a ballet, or this, or that, the other at the same time. You're writing music for a show in England, which you're doing mostly on a telephone. Then you do something for college up in Milton, who's doing the call, and they want music for the background, music for Murder in the Cathedral. And all these things, I mean, you just do them. I mean, you don't count them, you just do them. You don't make records of them, you don't. I mean, if you go by what's released on records, I mean, this doesn't constitute 10% of the productivity this year.
Having been a follower of your music way back from the Mood Indigo era.
Oh, it's a long time. It's Mood Indigo, it's 1931. I shall never forget 1931. I was 11 years old that year.
Thank you very much, Duke Ellington.
And team up with Frank Sinatra in an unusual new number in 1 minute here on the Monitor Beacon.
This is Andy Griffith. When the National Hemophilia Foundation in your community asks for support, I hope you'll join with me in responding. We all know hemophilia by another name, Bleeder's disease. Its victims, about 100,000 in the United States, lack a clotting element. They bleed easily, internally and externally, too easily and too long. It's not true a scratch or bruise is always fatal. It just may be. Recent progress may mean, eventually, an end to pain, crippling, hospitalization, and for some, early death. The door is opening for longer and fuller lives. But the hemophiliac will always need donated blood, about 200 times more than you and I will. He will always need understanding for support for education, vocational training, a job, the opportunity to live next door as your neighbor and friend. His future is in your blood. His hope is within your reach. Reach out through the National Hemophilia Foundation in your community.
January 29th, radio premiere week on WNBC, New York.
Stay right here on NBC.
And stay right here for Francis A. and Edward K. That's Sinatra and Ellington on Monitor with this brand new arrangement of Lerner and Lowe's Follow Me.
Through the clouds,
gray with years, over hills wet with tears, to a world young and free, we shall fly. Follow me. April green everywhere, April song always there. Come and hear, come and see, follow me. To the tree where our hopes hang high, to the dream that should never die, tomorrows still are in the sweet by and by. Time goes by, or do we? Close your eyes and you'll see, as we were, we can be. Weep no more, follow me. Follow me, follow me.
Sinatra and Ellington on monitor. Now meet a millionaire, this time in Nassau, the Bahamas. Reporter Candy Jones interviewed Preston Robert Tisch, president of Lowe's Hotels, who was there for the opening of his first hotel outside the United States. It's the Paradise Island Hotel, overlooking the ocean. Here's Candy.
I want to talk about how you became a millionaire. What motivated you, Bob?
Well, my brother Larry and myself graduated from college in 1947-48, and at that time we entered into the hotel business in our first hotel in Lakewood, New Jersey. Since that time, we've been very fortunate, and we've gone into the hotel industry in Atlantic City and then built our own hotel in Florida in 1955 called the Americana Bal Harbor. In 1959 and 1960, we bought control of the Lowe's Theaters, Inc., which later became the overall operation for our hotels and theaters and a listed company on New York Stock Exchange. And the hotel and our industry has grown for many, many years.
How many people on your team?
Well, Lowe's employs about 12,000 people at the present time, of which there are about 300 executives. And each hotel, like this hotel we're sitting in now, we have 640 on our staff.
When and where do you vacation?
Well, we try and vacation about twice a year, and I look for a nice sunny resort where we don't have a Lowe's hotel at this stage.
You don't stay in your own hotels?
Oh, I do at certain times if the family will be down here. on next Thursday for about 2.5 weeks. But then in March, mm-hmm. we'll be going down to one of the Caribbean islands. And May or June, we hope to go to Israel. And last year, we were in Marbella in Spain and looked for a nice beach resort where there's no noise, there's no hammering, and there's no telephones.
No telephones in particular, I'm sure. What one quality has helped you the most in making your business success and your fortune? Could you pinpoint it to one thing?
Well, I don't think there's any one thing. If you would ask me one thing, I'd say a lot of it is luck and timing.
You believe in luck.
And being in the right place at the right time.
But prepared?
And prepared, and to make use of the abilities and make use of what occurs. And the cliche of hard work, but hard work, you can't get anything accomplished unless you work at it, in my opinion.
Have you any advice for young people who would like to become wealthy?
They just have to keep doing what they like. They the most important is, instead of being wealthy, is that they're happy in what they're doing.
Exactly.
And,
but young people, I think, first of all, think, gee, I want to be wealthy, and they feel immediately happiness will come. Have you ever known unhappy millionaires?
Yes, I do. And I know a lot of them. And
what makes it that way?
They just can't find themselves. They just haven't got a purpose to be. You know, many people, and we don't know a lot of people in common. And we were discussing just yesterday that some who are well-to-do and have been left money, and some have made it, and they just can't make themselves happy. I mean, that to me, that's a shame.
It certainly is. Which do you feel is more respectful of his money, the one who has made it on his own or the one who has inherited his fortune?
Well, it's a hard question. Some of the people who have inherited fortunes, and I look at the Rockefellers, I think that they've gone on and done a tremendous job. They never made their money, as we all know, their father left it to them. There are others who have made it. It's enjoyable to make it because they have to have a reason to get up in the morning. That's their life, and that's what they enjoy. And if they took it away, it's like them going out and playing a game of golf or tennis, but doing it well.
Doing it well. Thanks a lot, Bob Tisch. I know how busy you are today. We've been speaking with millionaire president of Lowe's Hotels, Preston Robert Tisch, in his newest beauty, the Paradise Island Hotel and Villas in Nassau, the Bahamas.
I don't know if I'd rather be an inherited millionaire or a self-made millionaire, but I'd certainly like the chance to find out.
Love.
Best of Both Worlds by the little Scotch lassie, Lulu. Richard and the Flugel Knights with Camelot in the Western Massachusetts area. We're heard on WTAG. All the NBC stations get a word in here, and then we'll get together again for more of Monitor. I'm your host, Ted Steele.
This is Joe Garagiola. For a weekend look at what's new in the sports world, join me every Saturday and Sunday on Monitor on NBC Radio.
This is Monitor 68. We'll hear from a member of the younger generation 2 minutes from now. And later on, Joe Garagiola will talk about the All-Star Game. Which All-Star Game? All of them. And there are a lot coming up this week. I'm Ted Steele, and I tend to talk about music. Here's Instant Happy by the Johnny Man Singers. Younger Generation, a weekly report on Monitor with Linda Sutter.
If a single word were required to characterize this younger generation, I think the best one would be discontent. There's a discontent with the state of things as they stand and a desire to change them. Unfortunately, in most people's minds, this is characterized by rebellion, by hippies, drugs, demonstrations, and riots. And while these are undeniable and important, There's an enormous number of this younger generation working to change these things with which they're discontent. George Gorman is one of these. At 26 years old and a graduate of Princeton University, he's worked for the past 2.5 years with the New York Urban League's street academies in Harlem. George, can you tell me exactly what a street academy is?
A street academy is a school, but not in the sense of a tutorial center or something like that. It's a school in the old ancient sense of Socrates walking with his disciples. There are men there sharing their lives with each other. There are men there going through the changes, as a word used in Harlem a lot. A man is put through his changes in the street academy. We get guys who are hung up in all kinds of ways, or guys who've just never been offered much but mediocrity. And we tell them they can go to college. We tell them we've got a program in these academies that can get them into prep school. If they'll come every day and put themselves out, not just part of themselves, but all of themselves, we can get those men into college. And the academies are storefront schools, intake points for getting guys into prep school, on into college.
Now, how do you get these guys? Or do you recruit them, or do they come
recruit
in?
Recruit is not the word. We do what we call street work. And street work is a thing that there are dozens and dozens of the sharpest black guys, 25 to 35-year-old in Harlem, who are proud to be called street workers. They despise the idea of social work, but they are proud to be street workers. A street worker is a man's job. It's getting out there where the real action is, jumping into the core of the tornado, and beginning to focus on individual guys' lives, and above all, beyond all, relating to them at the level of their own interests, and much as possible the level of their own activities. I've learned to play basketball. I've been in the coffee shops. I've been on the streets late at night when the action's really happening. This is what street work is.
Can you give me, without necessarily mentioning a name, a specific example of how the street academies have changed a boy?
Sure. We can give you an example of a guy who I think of firsthand. He's now on our staff. He's one of the most exciting street workers that this country has ever seen. He's going to be a famous youth leader. This guy, when we first met him, was known as a crazy man. He was known as a guy who was a great basketball player but could never stay on any team because he'd be swinging at the coach with his great big huge fists or swinging at one of the referees. And we've seen this guy now assume real leadership on the streets of Harlem, helping dozens and scores of young guys who used to look up to him in one way. The guy, when I moved in with him, had 36 suits of clothing, all hot, and pairs of shoes that each cost $100, custom-made alligators. He was a hustler. Now kids are following him towards a different path, and he's going to lead them all the way to being college kind of guys who are going to come back and help the community just the way he is.
We're talking with George Gorman, who works in New York City's Harlem slum with the New York Urban League's street academies. Certainly a major cause of school dropouts is lack of funds. How do your students support themselves?
We are setting up youth businesses now to meet the needs in this area. One of the most exciting things that's been done is the creation of a newspaper completely written by the young people of Harlem. You feel the vibrancy in this little newspaper entitled, significantly enough, 40 Acres and a Mule. The editorial written by these kids explains that this was a promise made to them, and they certainly don't need the mule now, nor the 40 acres, I guess, but they're really out to redeem this promise through education. The proceeds are going into a scholarship fund that will enable these young men to go to college to fulfill their 40 acres and a mule, which is a college education. I know personally the kind of guys who some of whom are on our staff now, who can really change Harlem, and they're out to do it. And one of the things they want to do is make sure that this country is in good faith, and they're testing, and at every stage and in every statement, they're testing to see what kind of fiber is there.
How do you mean testing?
They're testing to find out if our country's for real. They're trying to find out if there is any real opportunity. Not just to have a $70 a week job at some bank, but whether you can actually be trained as an executive if you have the capacity. Now, what we have done, I think, through our street work contingent and our several Princeton guys and there are a number of other white guys, have proven that certain people are acting in good faith.
So you think there's hope, then? You don't see as dismal a picture as a lot of people do.
There is hope. The picture is dismal, but there is hope.
And all the more so because you, George Gorman, and the other people that are working up in Harlem in the street academies are working there. This is Linda Sutter reporting on This Younger Generation for Monitor.
A new song for all generations. It's Tommy Coe Jones and Don't Go Breaking My Heart.
La, 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 la.
Cosby in 1 minute here on the Monitor Beacon.
How long has it been since you've enjoyed a weekend on the town? Taken in a Broadway play, dined a dance the night away, saw a show at Radio City Music Hall, jogged along in a hansom cab through Central Park, or attended a sporting event at the Garden. It's all only minutes away when you stay at the New York Hilton, New York's newest, most modern skyscraper, with a picture window view of Manhattan. Park your car in their garage adjacent to the lobby. Check in quickly, zoom skyward in a high-speed elevator to your comfortable air-conditioned room. Here you'll find TV, automatic ice maker, and instant message system. Every hotel service imaginable, even continental breakfast in bed if you wish. In the lobby, a promenade of international restaurants. On the concourse, a Dutch coffee house. Everything to pamper you and extend a Hilton welcome for your memorable weekend on the town. For information and reservations, call the New York Hilton. Area code 212-JU6-7000. That's 212-JU6-7000. January 29th, radio premiere week on WNBC New York.
At 12 minutes before the hour, it's time for Monitor on Stage. Star performances recorded live at leading theaters and nightclubs all across the country. Here's comedian Bill Cosby with his reminiscences about his days on the team.
I played football at Temple University, and I was the third string fullback. The fact is, they knocked out all the other fullbacks and everything. But coaches have different methods of getting a team up. When I say getting a team up, I mean to make the players angry enough so they go out and really want to smash together. And one method that a coach used was that this guy would put a record on in the locker room, see, and the guy would play the record, and the music would go, pan, 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 dun, 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 dun. You know, the guys would, the glands would secrete in the air, and get strong and rip off the locker, and rip and tear the guys running around. And our coach went out and he bought the wrong record. He bought Exodus. We went out and everybody went home. But the real method, though, is that a coach will talk to a team. This is called getting them up. And our coach talked to us, never forget this game. He said, fellas, he said, you know, we're out here to win, and we really want to win because we want to win. You guys want to win? Yeah, coach. He said, all right, then start acting like it. Let me hear you say kill. Kill. Let me hear you say fight. Fight! Let me hear you say you want to win. We want to win. Are you guys ready? Yeah, coach, we're ready. Running around, tearing up the line, ripping up paper, busting the pigeon. We're ready. Good. Okay, are you guys ready? Say fight! Fight! And we're ready. Okay, go out there and get him. We ran, the door was locked.
Ah, that's a great sports story. Bill Cosby for Monitor on Stage. Here's Patti Page and Gentle on My Mind.
Knowing you don't try to buy my freedom with some promise made of gold. That for you my door stays open and our love becomes a simple two-way street. And it's knowing we're not shackled by forgotten words and bonds and the ink stains that have dried upon some lines. Keeps you on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, that keeps you ever gentle on my mind. It's not clinging to the rocks and ivy planted on some column now that binds us, or something that somebody said because they thought we fit together walking. It's just knowing that the world will not be cursing or forgiven when I'm drifting through the marketplace and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, and for hours you're just gentle on my mind. Oh, the wheat fields and the clotheslines and the junkyards and the highways come between us. Some other woman crying to her mother cause she turned and you were gone. I still might walk for hours, tears of joy might stain my face, and a summer sun might burn me till I'm blind. But not to where I cannot see you moving on the back roads by the rivers flowing gentle on my mind. Shutters creak in autumn winds that make me draw inside myself in silence. Cross-legged now, I sit and watch the endless chase of leaves across my yard. And laying down my hairbrush, I lean back within my window seat and find that you're moving on the back roads by the rivers of my memory, ever smiling, ever gentle on my mind.
Here's Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports, looking at the week ahead.
Sports record books often have some wild entries, and I've got one for them. The most all-star games in 1 week. Four. It started Tuesday night in Toronto's Maple Leaf Gardens, when the Maple Leafs played host to the outstanding players from the other clubs in the National Hockey League. The game, incidentally, was won by the Maple Leafs 4-3. Tomorrow, on opposite sides of the country, the two football leagues will hold their all-star games. The National Football League calls their game the Pro Bowl, and it'll be played in Los Angeles. The American League's All-Star game will be played in Jacksonville, Florida, and it'll come your way right here on NBC. Tuesday night in New York's Madison Square Garden, the top players in the National Basketball Association will play that league's All-Star game. For some of these games, the picture is changing, or figures to change very soon. In hockey, for example, the game last Tuesday night might wind up being the last of its kind. The league is divided into two divisions now, and probably by next year, it'll be the best in each division meeting each other, instead of having the All-Stars play one of the teams in the league. Also, the hockey All-Stars are chosen off their performances of the previous year, and I wouldn't be surprised to see that change, too. To have a real All-Star game, you should have the players who are doing well at the time the game is played. I can't help feeling that the two football leagues having their own All-Star games is on the way out, too. They're on their way to merging, and the Super Bowl has created tremendous interest all over the country. Before long, the fans should be making noises about wanting to see the best players of the two leagues play each other. There was a time when All-Star games didn't mean much to the players, but I think that's over now. These are the great ones, and you don't get to be a great one without pride. And the very fact that they're competing against the best makes them want to do well. I know that the baseball All-Stars feel that way, and if hockey changes to a game between the old and the new divisions, there'll be a little extra incentive for the players, not only to play in the game, but also to win it. Football is in the same position. I'm not going to tell you that the winner's share isn't enough to make a team like Oakland give it all they got in the Super Bowl, but there's more to it. They're playing for the prestige of their league, and that is important to an athlete. He wants to feel that he's playing in the better league. The All-Star game between the two leagues would have the same kind of prestige factor going for it. The two leagues are at the point now where a game like that would be of tremendous interest, both to the fans and to the players. For me, I'm an All-Star game fan. I like to see games involving the men who play those games best. During this week, I'll have had enough chances. This is Joe Garagiola for Monitor Sports.
And Joe's on Monitor's All-Star team every weekend and on NBC Radio Monday through Friday. That's new from Reuben Mitchell, a medley of Fiddler on the Roof and Matchmaker. Ah, they're doing things differently these days. It seems that firemen sped to the scene of an automobile accident yesterday and couldn't believe their eyes. The car was parked on the top of a tree. The tiny auto had swerved off the road, hit the tree, scrambled up the trunk, and finally settled on its topmost branches. Yes, things are different, huh? NBC News on the Hour is next, and then I'll be back with more of Monitor. I'm your host, Ted Steele.
The wheelers take a station break. Don't turn your set off, don't you make a mistake. Don't leave us behind, there's still lots more.